When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower. Now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
You know, Julie, I take the MARTA train here to the office. That's public transportation.
Heard of it.
Here in Atlanta. It's kind of limited. We just go north and south and east and west, and that's it. But
yeah.
But it's public transportation. It's the train. It's a melting pot of humanity, especially when it's hot. And I'm always seeing just kind of crazy stuff happening on the train.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally it'll be crazy enough that there's a moment where I have to question, is what I'm seeing legitimate human activity? Is this somebody that is addled, that is in danger, that is unhinged, or is this performance art? Is this somebody trying to make a statement about human nature right here on the train?
Because that is the thing about performance artists, right? Like, they completely decenter you. They make you stop and say, is this person truly sort of out of their wits? Or do they have something to say? And that is the goal of the performance artist.
Right. And as we'll discuss in this episode, too, at times it may seem that there is a gray line between madness and performance art. So
absolutely. With definitely some of the people we're going to cover, like, to what extent are they going to explore these ideas of our own humanness, our frailties, our power, by doing these acts that sometimes they actually will do to their bodies. We'll talk about that.
That arguably no sane person would do.
No. But they are interrogating what it is to be human, how we feel, how we think, how we act. What is morality? This is, you know, a question that we're always grappling with as humans. And I really think the artists are these nice additions to the scientific mind, to scientific researchers out there, because I think that they're doing the same thing that scientists are to some extent. They're going through the process of, here's a situation, and how can I examine it, and how can I peel away the layers to come to some sort of truth? What works and what doesn't? And to what extent do we even have free will? This is a question that comes up a lot with neuroscientists. And I think this is something that performance artists do really well, is exploring this topic.
Yeah, like you say, they drop truth bombs.
They do.
To quote Tracy Jordan. They, they're what strikes me about the performance artist is with a traditional artist, the art they create is kind of serves as a proxy by which they deliver truth to you. Like there's truth in the art mm-hmm. that the artist creates, and that is the means by which he or she gets the truth into your brain. But the performance artist, there's no proxy. Like they are becoming a vessel for that idea. They are becoming an idea, and they are forcing you to confront this idea mm-hmm. in the flesh. There are a lot of nude performance artists out there, and nudity is often plays into, I mean, because that is, that's the thing itself. There's a line in Shakespeare's King Lear, where Lear is, it's out in the, in the middle of the storm. Lear is mad. There's a fool that's pretending to be mad. Mm-hmm. And Lear says, "Is man no more than this? Consider him well. Thou owest the worm no silk, the beast no hide, the sheep no wool, the cat no perfume. Ha! Here's three uns are sophisticated. Thou art the thing itself. Unaccommodated man is no more but such a poor, bare, forked animal as thou art."
Okay, so that's really interesting because it's about stripping away, right?
Right.
The thing. And that's what I think is interesting about performance art is it does peel away our particular constructs of realities. Mm-hmm. Some of them built on how we as a society work, right? All these sort of rules that are either spoken or unspoken. And I wanted to talk about how performance art is actually an offshoot of Dadaism and even and futurists. And it has a pretty good run here, particularly from the 70s on. Laurie Anderson is someone who is associated with performance art, and I just wanted to mention this because this is a good example of, mm-hmm. of the type of performance art that began to be performed. She did Duets on Ice, which she conducted in New York and other cities around the world, and it involved her playing the violin along with a recording while wearing ice skates with blades frozen into a block of ice.
Now, Laurie Anderson, her husband?
Yes.
Satellite of Love.
Lou Reed.
Lou Reed, yeah. Because Anderson was also NASA's artist in residence for a short period of time.
She is an amazing artist, and she has, I believe that she's even, if I've got this right, I believe that she's even invented a couple of instruments as well. She's just
an amazing
thinker.
Yeah.
And so that's what I think is really interesting about performance artists is that they're bringing all those critical thinking skills to the table, and like scientists, trying to figure out, like, you know, these causal relationships and what happens when you, you know, push the needle here and there. Her performance, you know, there's no nudity, nothing too crazy, mm-hmm. nothing blowing up, but her performance ended when the ice had melted away. Another artist that people might be familiar with is Karen Finley, and I actually saw her in American Chestnut here in Atlanta, and that was very interesting. That was this interrogation of domesticity and a woman's role, and this was after she had a child, and she was actually using breast milk quite a bit to express herself, I guess you could say. But one of the things, the hallmarks of performance art, to me at least, is this lack of documentation, this symbol of the ephemeral nature of life, that everything is fleeting. And I wanted to bring this little quote out from a book called The Family Fang.
Okay. And yeah, this was one of yours on your summer reading list.
One of my summer picks. Yeah. It's really good. It's there in some ways it didn't quite live up to what I thought it might be, but other ways it really surprised me. It is about a family of performance artists, the parents in particular. And here's a quote from the father talking to child B, I believe. That's his son. he says, and I'm going to have to bleep this out a little bit. "Art happens when things effing move around," he told them, "not when you freeze them in a gall darn block of ice." He would then take whatever item was closest to him, a glass or a tape recorder, and smash it against the wall. "That was art," he said, and then he would pick up the pieces of the shattered object and hold them out for his children to inspect. "This," he said, offering the remains of the broken thing, "is not." Hmm. So again, it's this moment that's eliciting these certain emotions that I think are most central to performance art.
Yeah, and you know, and another thing that comes to mind as we were researching this and as we're discussing it now, there's also this line between performance art and just someone being a provocateur, you know?
Yeah.
You know, that someone that's just doing something shocking for the sake of shocking you. and certainly there are some individuals out there who just do that and call it performance art. Mm-hmm. But when you're dealing with real performance art, like performance art of a high caliber, there's that nugget of message in there somewhere.
Well, something that resonates a long time afterward. Like, for instance, you could see, what is it, the Naked Cowboy in New York who plays on the side of the street with the guitar?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if he's actually naked.
Yeah. And I wouldn't call it performance art. But I'm kind of picking on him a little bit because I don't think he builds himself as a performance artist.
Right.
But some people might go by and say, oh, that's so crazy. There's a, 6'5" dude who's pretty much naked and with a cowboy hat.
Yeah.
In the middle of Times Square.
Or some of the various individuals in Atlanta that have become famous for, like Baton Man, the baton guy that would march around with the baton.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Like that was, he wasn't pretending to be a performance artist. He was just doing it because it made him happy.
Yeah.
But
I haven't seen him in a long time.
Yeah, I haven't seen him recently either. I have, maybe he's good now. He doesn't need it.
Yeah, maybe got that baton thing out.
Yeah,
that baton demon that we all have. and then there's the flatulence that you hit me to the other day.
Oh yeah. Which I didn't even know was a real thing. I was reading a book. Marianne is Sleeping, I believe is the name of it. It was up for a big book prize about a decade back, and there was a farting artist in the book, but the whole book is like cloaked in dreams and dreams within dreams, so I just assumed it was made up, but we discovered yesterday that it is not. There's a grand tradition of individuals using their musical
scatting with their
abilities to
methane.
Yeah.
Actually, Mr. Methane is the name of one of the flatulists.
Yeah, that was on Britain's Got Talent,
mm-hmm.
A proud moment for the Empire. But so that is another example of something that is not quite performance art. But let's start getting into some of the examples that we're going to cover in this episode, because we want to hit some high points of performance art. Well, in some cases, you could call them. It's in the eye of the beholder. Some of these may be considered low points of performance art, depending on where you're coming from. But the idea is that the message is received. There's something worth talking about with all of the pieces we're going to discuss today.
So one of these gold standard performance artists is Maria Abramović, and she has been doing performance art for 40-something years. One of her most provocative pieces, though, is called Rhythm O. And I just want to mention, too, she's a New York-based Serbian performance artist. And she had a very interesting upbringing, too. I believe her parents were in the army, both of them.
Yeah.
Very rigid.
There's a documentary out about her.
It's
gotten a lot of media attention, playing on HBO, I believe.
Yes, it is. And we'll talk about that in a moment, too. That is called The Artist is Present. But Rhythm O was performed in 1974 in Studio Mora in Naples, and Maria Abramović adopted a really passive role with the audience as an active, taking on an active role.
Mm-hmm.
And she put 72 objects around her on a table, anywhere from flowers and perfume to nails, a knife, a hammer, and a loaded gun. And she just laid down, was very docile. She was naked. And then the members of the audience were allowed to use any of those objects on her in any way that they wished. And what she saw over this six-hour period is that people at first were pretty modest. They might pick up some perfume and put it on her. By the end, they were actually attacking her with some of these objects.
Yeah, one individual pointed the gun at her head.
Yes, and another individual took it away. Mm-hmm. So what you're seeing here is the audience became the show.
Yeah.
Essentially.
And she, the artist as the piece becomes this mirror in which we perceive ourselves.
Yeah, she said, what I learned was that if you leave it up to the audience, they can kill you. I felt really violated. They cut up my clothes, stuck rose thorns in my stomach. One person aimed the gun at my head, as you say, and another took it away. It created an aggressive atmosphere. After exactly 6 hours, as planned, I stood up and started walking toward the audience. Everyone ran away to escape an actual confrontation.
Wow.
So it was interesting because she had said, here are the rules. I'm going to sit here, but after 6 hours, I get up. So it's interesting that people ran away, sort of knowing that whatever this false contract was now broken. And it made me think about objectification, which is something we do on a daily basis, whether or not we know it all the time, right? Uh-huh. For a variety of reasons into a variety of things and people. And this is from The Atlantic. There's a study that came out. It said, study proof that we sexually objectify women. And the question of the study...
Because there needs to be proof of this.
Well,
as opposed to everything around
it. It's interesting, and it definitely relates back to, I think, what Abramovich was doing, mm-hmm. because there's this idea that, especially if the artist tells you, well, she didn't, you know, explicitly tell them, hey, I'm an object. Mm-hmm. But she did set the scene for that to happen to a certain extent to test the limits of what human behavior was like in that instance. But anyway, there is this idea of, like, straight up objectification. Mm-hmm. Can we quantify it? And do we really look at women differently than we do men when it comes to this? So what they said is we're going to give everybody, men and women, in our study, images of average fully clothed individuals. So no supermodels in bikinis, men or women. And these are going to quickly flash before the eyes of the participants. And then they'll be shown two side-by-side images that zoomed in on one, what they call sexual aspect. This could be like the midriff of right. a man or a woman. And they asked them to identify the version that hadn't been modified. And then the experiment was also reversed so that participants first looked at a specific part and then had to identify in the context the entire body. So the test was actually designed to clue researchers in on whether or not participants were using what they call global or local cognitive processing while looking at the images. In other words, whether or not they perceived individuals as whole mm-hmm. or in parts.
Hmm.
Which is fascinating to me.
Right.
So the results, regardless of gender, participants consistently recognize women's sexual body parts more easily when presented in isolation, and men's sexual body parts, on the other hand, were more memorable as part of their entire bodies. So what they're saying is that the cognitive process behind our perception of objects is the same that we use when looking at women, and both genders here are guilty of taking in the parts instead of the whole. But when we look at men, we globally process them more fully as people.
This is really interesting that we're talking about this during the Olympics, because the Summer Olympics start up, and you inevitably start seeing all these pictures from women's beach volleyball.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great little piece, I think it was a blog post, that was it was a great idea. I didn't think the execution was perfect, but it brought up the idea, what if all sports were photographed the way women's beach volleyball is photographed? Because we've all seen these images. Like, it's the only Olympic sport where it's okay for the photo spread of it to be women's hinders and midriffs, you know, without seeing their faces or necessarily even any sports action. Like, you don't see people shooting Greco-Roman wrestling like that or various winter Olympic sports. It's like sexual objectification theater.
Well, and this has been talked about a lot, over the years, particularly mm-hmm. in terms of...
They never even go swimming. Why are they wearing swimsuits, right?
I know. Particularly in gender theory, though, because that's what they call the male gaze, right? Like this idea that, you know, these body parts are being isolated.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about it in terms of, like, well, these different medias in which women have been represented have been in existence for thousands of years, right? But mm-hmm. more recently in the ways that we know them, through television or through our computer screens. And I thought, well, if we have evidence that a search engine like Google can change the way in which our memory works,
mm-hmm.
then is it possible that the way that women are portrayed in these different types of media could change the way that we think about men and women, as they say, like the cognitive processing of what a woman is or what a man is.
Yeah.
And so that's why I think it's interesting when you look at Maria Abramovich's work that she is considering, or it seems to me in some of the work that she's doing, she's considering this idea of objectifying yourself or being objectified. And I think that in her most recent work, which is a retrospective of all of her work, called The Artist is Present, she really kind of comes full circle with this idea of, well, let's focus more on acceptance rather than, and this holistic putting together of the human form as opposed to the objectification. And if you look at this documentary called The Artist Is Present, you'll see that she takes this retrospect of her work, which is fascinating, 40 years worth. Mm-hmm. People go through the exhibit, and I believe this was at MoMA, right?
Yes.
And this was earlier in this year, between March. For 3 months, this retrospective ran. So you go through this.
Was it already gone when you were in New York?
Yeah, it was, unfortunately. But you go through, and at the very end, the artist herself, as she says, is present. She is sitting at first at a table for a couple of months. And you, as a participant, are allowed to come and sit across from her. And I don't know for how long you can, but that's really a very simple idea, right?
Yeah.
The artist is present. I'm going to go and sit in front of her. But what we're talking about here, and this is when we say people are dedicated to their arts, or to performance art and to really seeing this through, this concept. We're talking about a 3 month period in which every single day she sat at that table and did not get up and did not eat and was absolutely silent. All told, a 736 hour and 30 minute static silent piece. That is part of her performance art. It's just sitting there in and of itself.
Yeah, like the endurance involved there. Like, it's not just somebody getting up and on a stage and being like, oh, I'm naked, it's art. No, this is somebody that's sitting there at a table for a grueling amount of time. I mean, I can't sit still for 15 minutes at a stretch most days. I can't even imagine the focus.
7 hours.
Yeah.
7 hours. And individuals coming and sitting in front of you. People were waiting for hours every day, by the way, just to do this. The reason is because she would, for every single person, she would, like before they sat down, she would look in her lap and then look up at them. And she said she wanted to give them the recognition they deserved as humans, as a whole human sitting in front of her. And she would say nothing, just stare in her eyes. Okay, have you ever stared into someone's eyes for 15 minutes straight before?
Well, my wife, I guess.
Not saying anything.
Not saying anything. Hmm. 15 minutes. No break in eye contact.
No break in eye contact, and it also a stranger, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I may not have, you know, because, I mean, generally, if it's somebody I really know, there's going to be some discussion, and I generally can't. I have trouble maintaining eye contact with most people who are not my wife. So,
well, it's such a simple idea, but when she did this in front of people,
now I have to look away from your eyes just because it's just the way I'm, like my
because they're piercing you.
Yeah,
with their gray steel.
Yeah, I look into someone's eyes, and it's like, and then I start getting uncomfortable, and I sort of look around.
But, yeah, I mean, so we're not really used to doing that, right?
Yeah.
We use our eyes to connect with other people, but certainly not for 15 minutes with a stranger. The sort of reactions were so incredible and powerful. People started crying. And the reason is because they're projecting all of their feelings onto her. She allowed herself to be a blank slate. And so a lot of people felt absolutely like that they fell in love with her. Some people were angry with her.
They felt judged or like they're they're imagining the way that she's viewing them.
Yeah. And then this documentary is fascinating to watch this happen. And people they just went nuts. And that's why she had people waiting for hours. Sometimes they would get there in the wee hours of the morning before the museum opened to stand in line to do this. There was a website called Maria Abramovich Made Me Cry that popped up. There were people who just started doing really disruptive things in the museum to get her attention. There was one woman who sat in front of her and took her top off because she wanted to try to be as raw and as vulnerable as Maria was. So, again, it's such a simple concept, but here's this woman who has really 40 years done these incredible things, not with her own, not just with her body, but really with interacting with people. And to me, this really was a culmination of, like, ultimate connection with someone.
I wonder, like, the people who did disruptive things, I wonder if they, were they familiar with her work enough to realize this is a lady who once, sat there and had a loaded gun next to her and allowed members of the audience to point it at her. I'm not going to really disrupt her by taking my top off.
I think it was the way
a loud noise is probably not going to cut it.
Well,
this lady, she is
someone
hardcore.
Had, I can't remember what they wrote on the papers, but they took a stack of like 500 papers and threw them from the top of MoMA, which, you know, they have an open atrium. So all these papers flew down. And there was sort of a negative sentiment on it. I can't remember off the top of my head what it was. But to me, it was someone trying to take a bit of that power that she had.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like when somebody messes with someone who's on guard duty or something, you know? I mean, you're just trying to... I mean, it comes down to the whole, like, even things like graffiti. And I don't mean street art, but just straight up, like, tagging something. I mean, it's about proving that you have control over something else. And it's petty.
Well, and at this point, too, in the exhibit, there was, like, this mania erupting over her. So it was crescendoing the nuttiness. But again, that's a powerful work, right, that is eliciting these feelings in people and connecting with them on such an incredible level. We should probably take a break, and then when we get back, we're going to talk about the crazy dude.
Well, yes, we're going to talk a little bit about the crazy and the brilliant Steelart.
Yes, the man with the ear on his arm.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like Eco Eye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
As we wave goodbye to winter's chill, it's time to give our lawn a little love and embrace the freshness of spring. And guess what? The Home Depot's Spring Black Friday sale is here to make it all a breeze. Snag the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and say goodbye to tedious yard work. With a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power, your lawn will look spotless in a flash. And the best part? Thanks to the convenience of online shopping, you can effortlessly place your order via the app, cruise into the store for pickup, and find yourself chilling in your freshly spruced up yard in no time. Don't let this awesome deal blow away. Get your hands on the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for only $89. Yeah, just $89. Exclusively during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
All right, we're back. So let's talk a little bit about Steelart. This guy is pretty incredible. He's probably most well known for the ear on the arm deal, which unless you actually, this is one of those things that, like a lot of things, that gets picked up in the media and gets carried on. I think a lot of people just have surface level information about it. Like, their basic level of the story is, oh, there's some crazy artist dude and he had an ear sewn onto his arm. Which isn't really the case at all,
right?
But what he did is really fascinating, and then it it ties in with some of the things we've discussed in the past about growing organs and you know where we're going as far as body modification, mm-hmm. cybernetic enhancement, growing human tissue over scaffolding. I mean, and all of these things are involved, particularly in this piece, but also in a lot of his work.
Right. And we've talked about it more in the context of survival, either in space or just in trying to help with disease or, you know, just even like organ replacement.
Yeah.
So, yeah, along comes this guy, and he starts to get his thinking even more about this topic.
Yeah. Now, but before we got to – this is 2006 when he had the ear done. Before that, he did a lot – like a lot of what he was doing was like he would do body suspensions where he has hooks in his skin and he's hanging. Everyone,
which is a little like Jim Rowe circus.
Yeah. He's – and a lot of what he does I think I read a piece that William Gibson wrote. It was actually the introduction to Steelark, the monograph, which is a collection of his work, where he talked about it. His work as invoking like the sideshow geek, you know, roadshow kind of vibe, and also but also all these other disciplines to make some commentary about where we are with the people and how we interact with technology and ultimately where we're going. So he did a lot of that. He did a piece where he swallowed a sculpture.
Yeah.
A sculpture that kind of opens up in his stomach, and there was apparently a tricky moment where he wasn't sure he was going to be able to remove it without surgery.
Right. I mean, he could have died from it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He did a piece called Ping Body in which he wired himself to the internet. By attaching electrodes to various muscles, which could then be activated by remote users.
Mm-hmm.
And, this was all about sensory experience and the idea that increasingly today and certainly in the future, our sensory experience isn't bound to a particular location or bound by the body itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's forcing you to think about our modern sense experience as being this international thing, you know? I mean, it comes back to like doing Google image searches of things and how does that change our perception of the world. But then the ear idea came to him. And the ear idea, apparently, he had it, you know, back in the mid-90s and spent 10 years tracking down people who had actually performed surgery.
I read somewhere he said, if the technology would have been present then, I would have gone ahead and pursued it.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to wait until we could actually do this.
Yeah. And I mean, that's something to say, surgical technology hasn't really caught up with my art yet.
Yeah.
You know, that's generally considered a statement of someone who is deeply disturbed or someone who is deeply creative. So 2006, the day finally arrives. A biocompatible scaffold is surgically inserted into his left forearm, and it creates the shape of an ear.
So it's not yet, it's not an ear per se.
Right. It's, you know, we mentioned scaffoldings. We can grow tissue. We can use stem cells to grow tissues. We can grow heart tissue.
Mm-hmm.
But we need the shape of a heart around which to grow it. And this is a scaffolding of an ear.
Mm-hmm.
It was just surgically implanted under the skin. And it actually took successive surgeries in a 6-month bout with infection. He had to take all these antibiotics. So it wasn't just a simple procedure of you know, sliding it in. Like, this dude suffered for his art. And now has an ear shape in his arm. But that's just sort of stage one.
Right. 6 years later, he's still adding to it, right? Like with his own adult stem cells.
Yeah, because he wants to give it a lobe. It doesn't really have a proper lobe.
Yeah.
Because that's not really part of the scaffolding. The fleshy lobe is fleshy.
Yeah.
And lobey.
Right. And he's got an idea about that, too, because eventually he wants to insert a small microphone that connects to a wireless transmitter.
Yes.
And he says that in any Wi-Fi spot in the world, he'd be able to have that ear become internet enabled. So he says, if you're in San Francisco and I'm in London, you'll be able to listen in to what my ear is hearing wherever you are and wherever I am. And again, here's this idea of it's not just this person doing this solo act. I mean, he's really trying to connect with humanity in this other way.
Yeah, so we can reach a point where you can go to a website and you can listen through Steelark's arm ear. And that's pretty amazing. He apparently gets kind of touchy about how it's described.
Yeah.
There was a Wired magazine interview with him in 2012. And this is how he describes the ear He says, quote, partially surgically constructed, partially cell grown. And this year, it's been confirmed now, we'll be doing the augmentation of the helical part of the ear to make it more prominent, and will also grow a soft earlobe using my extracted adult stem cells. So, it's pretty mind-boggling. And this is not the end. This is not his final piece by any stretch of the imagination. He has other plans for the future.
I know it sounds ridiculous probably to all the listeners, like, ah, oh, this guy putting, you know, sculpting an ear so that it can then be wired. But, you know, we talked about, you know, in Contact Lenses of the Gods, we mm-hmm. talked about augmenting our own reality.
Right.
And using contact lenses that are essentially hooked up to the internet that can project certain images. So when you start to look at it in that way, it's not too far along. Of course, not all of us are going to graft tissue onto ourselves and
right.
wire it. But he is exploring this idea of different ways of communicating and perceiving the world.
Yeah, and once you get, like, performance art is to a certain extent like all art is kind of like a door to a room. And if you just look at the door, you don't walk through that door. If you just judge it at face value and be like, ah, some crazy dude put an ear on his arm, or ah, somebody painted a bunch of colors on a canvas, you're not going to get anywhere. You're not going to engage with the piece. But once you get past that level, like, you know, that kind of shock level, and
mm-hmm.
you think about what you're perceiving and what this guy's doing and why he's doing it, that's where the performance art really forces you to think about the at times hard or fascinating truth regarding human nature.
Or technology in this case. He actually said, I really like this quote, he said, artists can be early award warning systems, generators of contestable futures, possibilities that can be examined, evaluated, perhaps appropriated, often discarded. Well, that's a good way to look at it, because we have all these technologies coming online, and we often talk about that. How is that going to affect us 50 years out? So on and so forth. And here's this person who's extrapolated a lot of these ideas onto his own being.
William Gibson, in his foreword to the Steel Art, the monograph, he talked about meeting him for the first time. And there's this great little bit I wanted to read from that. Gibson, of course, is the author of Neuromancer and more recently books such as Pattern Recognition, which, you know, all of his books deal with technology and how humans are changed and how we interfere and involve ourselves with technology. Gibson says, I imagine now that I was watching Steelark in performance with his robotic third arm, but what I recall experiencing was a vision of some absolute chimera at the heart of a labyrinth of breathtaking complexity. I sense that the important thing wasn't the entity Steelark evoked, but the labyrinth that the creature's manifestation suggested. Which I thought was a nice way of summing it up. It's not so much look at this freak with a third arm, or look
mm-hmm.
at this freak with an ear on his arm. Now, this is like, think of the world that sort of flows out from this piece. In the same way that a lot of this performance art is about forcing the viewer to think about themselves. He forces the viewer to think about the world that we've created for ourselves.
Yeah, and it appears that he doesn't have an opinion one way or the other in terms of this sort of technological augmenting of his body and, you know, making a statement about dystopian future versus utopian future.
Right.
And he doesn't think of himself much as a futurist.
Yeah, he doesn't think of himself as a futurist. And Gibson was rather dismissive of the – he's like, I don't think he's talking about the future at all.
So. No, he says – and in fact, he says on the point, he says, I don't think that machines will take over at some imagined point in time, a singularity. I think it will be much more complex. There will be multiple and alternate possibilities that will be constantly generated. This is another perspective on that.
As for the future, Steelark has a couple of projects planned. Just going to mention them
here.
First, he wants to engineer a, quote, insect-like microbot that will climb into his mouth, unquote. And this will have a webcam and a LED light. It reminds one of the mermaid, the endoscopic cameras that we've
mm-hmm.
Talked about in previous episodes. Well, he is taking the artistic approach with this technology, which is fascinating. And then he also wants to grow a microbial second skin. And this would involve covering his body with a layer of agar, which is that...
Right.
That clear stuff you see in petri dishes.
Mm-hmm. It's the medium that helps grow the culture.
Yeah, we had some of this when we did the video series.
We did.
Yeah, if I'd known, we should have ordered more of it, and I could have slathered myself with it and grown more skin. But no, he would be growing a skin of microbes, and he has some fantastic ideas about what that would mean and all, and so we'll just see how that unfolds.
Isn't he going to encase himself for like 3 days in it or something, and then he's going to discard it but allow it to continue to grow yes. Matter on it?
Yes.
Microbial matter. So. I want one of those. Although I think that if I wore microbial second skin all the time, I wouldn't get the benefit, of course, of my own good microbes hanging out.
Well, you know, it comes back to MARTA. I feel like I have encountered individuals on the train who have grown a microbial second skin, but they were not performance artists.
All right. Let's shift over. Now that we have this kind of foundation with a couple of artists who have, I really think, set the bar here
in
terms of dedication and big themes, let's tick off a couple others. There's Guillermo Vargas.
Yes, Costa Rican.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy is rather controversial. And this is the guy I was definitely thinking of when we were talking about the highs, but also potentially the lows of performance art. Tell us about his piece with the dog.
Okay, this was in Nicaragua in 2007 at a gallery.
Which neighbors? Costa Rica.
It was at a gallery there, and it featured a dog tied to a wall with a short length of rope, and the words "Eres lo que lees," you are what you read, were written on the wall with dog food.
A really rough-looking street dog.
That is not being fed.
Right.
And yet there is dog food around it. So it caused a ton of controversy, and especially when it was reported that the dog actually died of starvation.
Yeah. So let's, like I said earlier, art is this doorway into this room of truth and thought and contemplation and confrontation. At the door level to this piece, it's pretty horrendous, right? Like this dude brought in a dog, tied it up, intentionally didn't feed it, and it died. But
the audience is also part of this.
The audience is present. Did the audience feed the dog?
No. According to the gallery director, he said that during the exhibition, he didn't have any visitor that tried to free the dog, feed it, or call the police.
Yeah. And the other part of the statement here, too, is everyone gets super up in arms. Oh, my God, a dog starved to death. And this guy just let it happen. But that's a dog he got off the street, where there are all these other dogs starving on a daily basis, where there are humans starving. And that is not the point of outrage. The outrage is that it took place there as performance art.
Right, right. But, I mean, you could take his stance and say that what the art piece was really about was a diffusion of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about this in the bystander effect before.
Yeah.
And there have been a ton of studies carried out to say that when people get together and they see, atrocities or they see something that seems wrongheaded, we don't always fly to the best natures of our beings, right? That we sometimes shirk responsibility. And social psychologist John Darley and Bib Latane concluded that the larger number of people who witness something at a scene of emergency or crime, for instance, the lower probability that an individual will act. So we've seen this in a couple of different ways. There's something called pluralistic ignorance. And this is a collective inaction by a group because you kind of look to the other person for a cue.
Yeah.
And if the other person seems like, well, no, it's not that serious, then nobody else thinks it's that serious.
Comedian Louis C.K. has some great bits about this in his stand-up, but also on the show, Louis, mm-hmm. That involve like walking past people on the streets of New York who are in really bad shape, and having to, and then being there with somebody who's either an outsider that's visiting New York or somebody who's just in a, maybe has a different state of mind that says, let's help this guy. Does he need help? And Louis's like, yeah, he needs your help more than anything, but we just don't do that.
Yeah, I think it was, an example was like a teenager or something.
Yeah.
That had never been to the city before mm-hmm. and was trying to help a homeless person. He was like, oh, honey, we don't do that.
Yeah.
And to your point, like, yeah, that person does need all the help in the world, but we just don't do that. And that's this idea, too, the diffusion of responsibility. Somebody else is in charge, or somebody else may be better to deal with this than you or I.
Yeah.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or a ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
As we wave goodbye to winter's chill, it's time to give our lawn a little love and embrace the freshness of spring. And guess what? The Home Depot's Spring Black Friday sale is here to make it all a breeze. Snag the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and say goodbye to tedious yard work. With a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power, your lawn will look spotless in a flash. And the best part? Thanks to the convenience of online shopping, you can effortlessly place your order via the app, cruise into the store for pickup, and find yourself chilling in your freshly spruced up yard in no time. Don't let this awesome deal blow away. Get your hands on the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for only $89. Yeah, just $89. Exclusively during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
So that is why that piece is interesting. It's awful.
Yeah. Like, we are not forgiving the, you know.
It was hard for me to research it, to be quite honest. It's called Exposición Number 1, in case anybody wants to look into it further. But it's definitely a commentary on society.
Yeah. And, like, when I was in Costa Rica, I visited the art museum there, and I do not remember there being a dog tied up. So, but there was a lot of fine modern art there. So,
because it bit it by that time.
Yeah. But let it be known that Costa Rica has a lot of very talented artists who don't harm dogs.
Yeah, and this was in Nicaragua anyway. Yeah. So yeah.
Where it's also pointed out that there were no laws in Nicaragua against what he did, so he wasn't actually breaking the law per se.
Right. Right. I'm not sure that's something you could do in the United States.
Right. Definitely not.
All right. So Damien Hirst is another person we'd like to talk about. A lot of people are familiar with him, particularly with some of the formaldehyde preserved carcasses or animals that he's actually done in the past.
Oh, like the big shark, the 1991 piece, The Physical Impossibility of Death in the Mind of Someone Living. which is like this big formaldehyde tank, sort of three divisions. Well, it's not really three divisions, but it has like, they're looking at it, it looks like there are three sections to it.
Yeah.
And there's this giant shark in there. And like, it was an actual shark that he commissioned somebody to catch that was his only mandate on it was it needs to be big enough to eat somebody. Because that's sort of, that's the idea of the shark as a manifestation of human mortality. Here is something in the food chain, something out there in the world big enough to eat you.
Yeah.
And perfectly capable of carrying it out.
And here it is, completely vulnerable, rendered in front of you, right?
He's
sort of obsessed with death and I guess, you know, putrefaction, preservation. What I've seen before is Mother and Child Divided. I saw the Tate Gallery, and that is a calf and its mother that are bisected. Mm-hmm. And so they're in four different formaldehyde cubes, and you can walk through them. You can actually see the bisection, the inside of their guts and so on.
Yeah.
And sort of that's kind of a play to mother and calf divided.
Yeah. Of course, not everything he does involves dead animals. He also has some wonderful sculpture. There's, in fact, one of my favorite sculpture pieces, which I've never actually seen in person, but I've seen plenty of great photographs of it, his 2005 piece, Virgin Mother. If I can find, I'll either include a link or an embedded picture of this when we do the blog post that goes with this episode, because it's just beautiful. It's painted bronze, and there's kind of like a half of it is like an anatomical dissection of a pregnant woman, and then the other half is fleshed, and it's just a beautiful piece of art.
Yeah, I mean his rendering is no doubt. There's a lot to celebrate in terms of that.
Yeah. It's not
really a sculpture.
Yeah, so he has the skill. It's not like he's one of these guys that's just like, here's a dead shark, it is art. Look at it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
You know, there's a lot more going on here.
But I do want to point out that he submitted plans for his 97,000-foot, what he calls art plant.
Okay.
It's 97,000 square feet of plant in rendering these animals. He actually has a formaldehyde studio built into this plant and like hooks where all the carcasses hang.
Wow.
So, I mean, he's still obviously interested in this. But this is actually animal carcasses, 67-foot sculptures. There's another one called the Angel of the West that he's trying to get done right now. This is actually not what we're talking about. We want to talk about this skull is bedazzled beyond bedazzlement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's covered in diamonds.
Yes, and it's a plastum cast of a real human skull with real teeth, encrusted with 8,601 diamonds. And that totals something like at the time 14 million pounds, mm-hmm. right? And it is rumored that he sold the piece to a conglomerate, and that I think he sold it for like 50 million pounds.
Wow.
But we don't even know if it'll be exhibited again. This is such an incredible piece and so very expensive. If you look at it, you will be dazzled by it. You can't not be dazzled by it. And Hearst himself said he was really surprised by how it came out because he really wanted to interrogate death and look at it, in a different light. And he said that he thinks that there's more of a positive spin to the skull, that it's like the glory of death as opposed to like death as we always think of as the Grim Reaper.
Yeah. Like a fabulous death.
Yes, it is a fabulous, it looks as though it's awesome. Yeah. When you look at that, oh, death, that's great. Get bedazzled.
Yeah, he's certainly more of a multimedia artist. Like there's some performance aspects to his work, mm-hmm. but then again, some of it is more traditional sculpture as well.
Yeah. And there were people who said, like, you know, there's a comment on this, too, because of blood diamonds and the mining practices. Mm-hmm. There's another aspect that you can take away from it. To me, I think, is this, like, the ultimate totem of denial of, like, of our own mortality, mm-hmm. that you dress up death. But in any case, you guys should definitely go and Google it. It's worth a look.
Yeah. And again, I'll try to include an embedded image or at least a link to it. So, like a lot of the pieces we're discussing here, so you'll be able to handily seek them out when you listen to this podcast. Okay, we have one more artist that we want to discuss here, and that is Michael Landy.
Yes, not Michael Landon.
Not Michael Landon. though his performances were gold.
They were.
Yeah.
I will never forget Pa. All right, so in 2001, this installation artist spent 2 weeks destroying all of his worldly possessions. We're talking about 7,000 or more, mm-hmm. 7,000 and change objects, including like cooking utensils, but also original works by Damien Hirst.
Wow, yeah, okay. Like things that beyond just merely stuff, but like things that this is the only one that exists.
Yeah, yeah. You're like, oh, that's $20,000. Well, I'll burn it. Yeah. What else? Family photos, his Saab, his car,
mm-hmm.
and. This, I think, if I read this right, from an article, was an idea he had after one of his art installations in 1994 was thrown away. Do you know of this?
Oh, this is the one, yes, where the art installation itself resembled garbage.
Yes.
And not, I've not in a, like I told you about when I went to London and I was on the ferry, and we, the ferry tour guide was this Cockney gentleman, and he was talking about the Museum of Modern Art there in London. He was like pointing
to
it. It's like, oh, you can go over there, but it's just a bunch of rubbish. I went in there and I saw a piece and I was like, oh, I can throw a pizza carton in the garbage. Oh, just make some art. You know, and he's like just really ragging on it. But that's exactly why. This was garbage, as art, but then was interpreted by a janitor as garbage.
And thrown away.
Thrown away.
Right. And so I think that this is what spurred him on to say, huh, what if, you know, I just lost this installation of garbage. What if I turn this to my own life? What would happen to me?
Right.
If all my worldly possessions were just smashed to smithereens.
It's like, it reminds one of the story of Vincent van Gogh having to burn his paintings for warmth on the balcony.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just something. I mean, and also brings to mind Tibetan monks creating these mandalas out of sand and then destroying them. There's something about, I mean, it's creation and destruction, the two primal forces in life displayed there. I mean, that's the core of art right there.
Right. Within every man sleeps the great destroyer, right? And he took that. I mean, and literally destroyed everything. And not everybody could say they could do that, right? And then there's this idea of personhood that we talked about, like your identity being bound up with things.
Yeah.
And the sort of liberation from that.
From stuff.
From stuff, man. So, all right, that's a little poo-poo platter of artists in this field.
Cool. Well, speaking of two quick notes. Speaking of poo-poo platter, just want to mention real quick, if you downloaded an early version of our fecal fossil episode, there's a little bit where I was talking about owl pellets, and I got caught up in the moment and talked about them coming out of an owl's rear instead of an owl's face. Pellets are, of course, vomit. We subsequently edited that part out because it's just like a quick, couple of minute deal where I started rambling about it unplanned. And obviously, pellets come out of an owl's mouth. It is vomit. But
something you know very well, since you have sought these pellets
for
more than a year.
And I did a blog post about it, so I don't know why. I got wires crossed in my head or something on that one. But if you download the current version of it, that error is absent. And let's see if we have a quick listener mail. Call over the robot real quick. All right. Our listener, Murphy, from Hawaii, writes in and says, "Hey, Robert and Julie, just listened to your podcast on screaming. I've recently graduated from high school, and I gotta love it. Being out, I mean. The last few years of my high school caused me to become very stressed, and I would occasionally have screaming fits. I would get all wound up over a day or so, start babbling, and then I would finally scream. I would belt out around 4 or 7 good screams, rest, and I would feel better afterwards. While screaming can be a good release every once in a while, I've learned to avoid such dramatic incidences by reacting to things that bother me. When they bother me. This is becoming ramble-esque. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. Aloha, Murphy of Hawaii." So.
All right.
Yeah. Well, you know, that was, we were hearing from the heart there on Murphy. I found it interesting that he used the goodbyes, but then the aloha, which means goodbye and hello, right?
I know, and I was just trying to make a joke like about mahi-mahi in my head, but it didn't quite come together.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Someone who's using really some scream therapy of their own to deal with their issues.
Well, especially in high school, right?
That's,
yeah.
Who obviously, if you're not screaming in high school, then you're probably a jerk. I don't know. I mean, it's like if you're not suffering, you're probably causing other people to suffer. That's kind of my take. Unless you go to a great high school. Anyway, do you go to a great high school? Do you have thoughts on screaming? But more to the point, do you have some thoughts on performance art? If you've seen some great performance art out there in person, if you're familiar, a big fan of a performance artist that we didn't mention on the podcast, but you think, you know, you'd really like to get their story out on the podcast, let us know. Are you a performance artist? That would be great as well. We'd love to hear from you. You can find us on Facebook, where we are Stuff to Blow Your Mind. And on Twitter, you'll find us under the handle Blow the Mind.
And you can also drop us a line at blowthemind@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah, and some waves so we could go surfing.
Oh, ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Tenor girl go shopping.
Yeah, baby.
Wait, did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.